therapist Amy Lutzke. We have a fantastic team here at WRT, and I'm so grateful for working with all of them to produce this show. And I'm thankful and grateful for all of you who listen and call in and help support the show. So thank you, listeners, for joining us today on A Public Affair here at WRT 89.9 FM Madison. Stay tuned today for Madison Bookbeat.
The mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it. 6 foot six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level.
You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. Stay tuned for BBC headlines.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. Donald Trump has said the United States will not put up with Volodymyr Zelensky's position on a ceasefire for much longer. The Ukrainian leader said over the weekend that an end to the war with Russia was far off. The US president put out a statement on his Truth social media platform saying this was the worst statement Mr. Zelensky could have made. Here's Namia Iqbal.
As far as President Trump is concerned, he is doubling down, as we've seen from this post that he's put up on his Truth Social platform. And over the weekend, the Republicans pretty much fell in line with him. And you have Republicans who are calling for President Zelensky to more or less step down. Remember, the Republicans control all three branches of government. And so this position that they're all taking with President Zelensky is pretty damning.
The authorities in Germany say they do not suspect that a man believed to have carried out a deadly car ramming in the southwestern city of Mannheim acted out of extremist or religious motives. They say two people were killed. Danny Eberhard reports.
Once again, a German city has been swept up in scenes of panic. Just after noon, a black car was driven at speed into people enjoying a sunny spring day at carnival time in the pedestrian heart of Mannheim, a city south of Frankfurt. It sparked a massive response from the security and emergency services. Ambulances took some of those injured to hospital. Police say the detained suspect is a 40-year-old German. They currently believe the suspect did not have any political motive, but they haven't specified what might have prompted the incident.
The UN Children's Agency says the Israel-Hamas ceasefire in Gaza must hold, as it warned of the devastating consequences of Israel's aid blockade. People in the Palestinian territory say food prices have soared since aid was cut off on Sunday. A UNICEF spokesperson, Rosalia Bolin, said people in Gaza were in dire need of assistance.
At the moment, we have some items left that we had collected previously, but because the needs in Gaza are just staggering, we have been trying to distribute the items that we've been bringing in as soon as we could. So we've been handing them out to families, to the most vulnerable children and families in Gaza.
Violence has broken out in the Israeli parliament as guards clashed with families affected by the October the 7th Hamas attacks. At least two people were injured as bereaved relatives from a group representing some 1,500 families tried to get into the visitors section. World News from the BBC. The Vatican says Pope Francis suffered two episodes of acute respiratory failure on his 18th day in a Rome hospital, where he's been treated for pneumonia. A statement said the breathing problems had been caused by an accumulation of mucus in the lungs, which was removed. The Vatican said the Pope, who's 88, has been put back on mechanical ventilation. The UN's food agency is closing its Southern Africa bureau in Johannesburg, despite a severe drought in the region. The World Food Programme, which relies on the US for nearly half its budget, says it's had funding constraints after President Trump slashed foreign aid contracts. Last year, Malawi, Zambia, Zimbabwe and Namibia declared a national disaster in response to the worst drought to hit Southern Africa in years. The launch of Europe's first commercial space shuttle, Ariane 6, has been postponed for a second time. Ben Morris has more details.
The launch from Europe's spaceport in the middle of French Guiana was meant to put a French military observation satellite into orbit. The operator, Ariane Space, said it was forced to call off the launch at the last minute due to what it called an anomaly on the ground. A previous attempt scheduled late last month was also called off. Ariane 6 is trying to enter an increasingly competitive and lucrative market. The Amazon owner Jeff Bezos successfully launched his own commercial spacecraft earlier this year.
The Indian Cricket Board has defended its men's one-day international captain Rohit Sharma after a politician accused him of being unfit. In a post on social media, Shama Mohammed from the opposition Congress Party said Sharma was fat and needed to lose weight. A board official said the comments were derogatory and demoralising. BBC News.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Madison Book Beat, your listener-sponsored community radio home for Madison authors, topics, book events, and publishers. I am your first Monday of the Month host, Andrew Thomas, and I'm very pleased to welcome my guest today, Stephen Jung, for a live conversation on his debut poetry collection, At the End of the World, There Is a Pond, published just this past January by W.W. Norton. Stephen will be here in Madison on Wednesday, March 12th, to give a reading at a Room of One's Own bookstore on 2717 Atwood Avenue from 6 to 7 p.m. So if you like the preview that you're receiving today, you should definitely plan on checking him out next week. And when you're there, you can also pick up a signed copy of the new collection. In addition to my conversation with Stephen today, WART is also in the midst of its spring pledge drive. It's that time of the year where we come to you, new and loyal listeners alike, and ask for your financial support to keep the station up and running, especially in our current political climate now. We need it more than ever. So we'd very much love to hear from you, and we have our volunteer phone answerers standing by. Today it is Mary Lou and Amy, so please give them a call at 608-256-2001. Again, that is 608-256-2001. You can also pledge online at wortfm.org. You can click on the big orange donate button in the upper right-hand corner. You'll be hearing from me and WART Talk producer Sarah Gabler a few more times during the show, but for now, let's turn to my conversation with Stephen Jung. Stephen Jung is a writer from San Diego. His poems have appeared in the American Poetry Review, Guernica, and the Yale Review, among other publications, and his short fiction is featured in Catapult, The Drift, and the Best American Short Stories of 2024. The recipient of fellowships and awards from the Academy of Stephen is the recipient of fellowships and awards from the Academy of American Poets, as well as the Iowa Writers Workshop. And he is currently a creative writing fellow in poetry at Emory University. He lives in Atlanta, Georgia. Stephen, welcome to Madison Book Beat, and it is a pleasure having you on the air.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here. Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, WART. I'm really pumped. I'm also just want to say it was really thoughtful of you to pronounce my name like that. I don't know that anyone has ever pronounced it like that besides like Viet Thanh Nguyen one time, and then my mom. So that's really thoughtful. It is spelled D-U-O-N-G, but that's thoughtful.
Oh. Well, thank you. You know, I studied some like Vietnamese history when I was in grad school, and one of the things that I learned is all the different kind of intonations of the Vietnamese language and how a word like ascending or descending can mean different things. So I was tuned in a little bit to like how is this actually pronounced? So yeah, it's a beautiful language to hear spoken. Well, yeah, Stephen, thank you for joining us ahead of your visit to Room of One's Own next week. And, you know, I should start by saying congratulations on publishing your debut poetry collection. I'm sure it's a real joy and probably a bit of a relief to see it out in the world. Talk to us a little bit, like, what have the last few months been like for you now that your collection is its own independent, freestanding organism out in the world now that you could see in a bookstore window?
Yeah, it's been really strange. I guess, yeah, January 14th was, I guess, the book's birthday. But yeah, it's been out for a while now. It's still strange to see it in bookstores. I've just been really pleased, honestly, to hear people picking it up. I mean, obviously, like friends and family and people who know me. But then I'll get like messages from people I don't know at all, who just have encountered it somewhere. Maybe they read like a publication or something, or an interview, and they, you know, it made its way to them. I have people who said they received it as like a gift from a friend, which is, you know, thanks to whoever did that, whoever gifted the book. It's just taken a long time to come together. Like the oldest poem in the book, probably drafted it somewhere around 2018 or something like that. And, you know, the most recent, maybe 2023. So it spans a big period of time. And so it's kind of wild to see this book in the world that kind of represents multiple versions of, you know, me and my writing practice. So, yeah, it's been an honor.
In the creative writing circles that you move in, is that generally how a collection comes together? Is it something that is built over time, or do folks kind of have, and maybe I should preface this with a debut poetry collection, because maybe once you become more seasoned as a writer and publish more, it changes a little bit. But for a debut poetry collection, do you find most of your peers, it's these collections that's, you know, poems that span 6 or 7 years? Or do folks go in with a very kind of intentional idea about, oh no, this collection is going to do a very specific type of thing, either formally or the subject matter that it's engaging with?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I describe this to, I mean, the way I describe it to some people, to my students especially, is I talk about the difference between, you know, like a mixtape and like a concept album, something like that, you know, where, you know, I think like maybe that, you know, it would maybe be an oversimplification to call like this first collection and to call first, you know, debut collections in general mixtapes. But I feel like this particular book came about through a sense of like accumulation. Like it was like an empty thing, and it started filling up and filling up. And then the fuller it got, you know, the more I was able to see what it was, what the original shape, you know, that was being filled up was. I know there's a lot of books that I really like and that are, you know, just like more like focused project books, I would call them. Like I really love the book Look by Solmaz Sharif. That's like an incredibly cohesive like project book, but I also do know that, you know, it came about in bits and pieces. So I think it's probably a mix of both. I'm trying to think of like, I have friends who have done something different, but yeah, I think a lot of people, it's sort of a process of accumulation, and then it starts to take shape, and then you sort of snip and change it like a little bonsai, you know, and put the wire on and encourage it to grow in the right way. Yeah.
Or maybe in this instance, the one of the metaphors that moves throughout the, or a lot of the metaphors are fish, you know, ponds, swim, you know, so maybe manicuring it kind of like a koi pond or something like that.
Yeah, there's something called aquascaping, which is, it's like gardening, but for your fish tank. So if you ever see like a beautiful, beautiful fish tank with very carefully arranged plants, you know, somebody aquascaped it.
an aquascape collection of poetry. Well, you know, it's a beautiful collection, and from the writing process of getting your first debut book out there, what experiences do you want to carry forward with you as a writer, and what are some of the other things that you'd like to leave behind?
Yeah. So for the past couple of years, this is my second year. I'm sort of getting to the end of my second year here at Emory. But before that, I was mostly focused on fiction. I was in grad school for fiction. I was working on stories and a novel. And that's kind of where at least in terms of drafting, you know, new work, that's sort of where I am now. And this whole process has been, it's been kind of strange. I mean, with poetry, it's so different than publishing fiction. I guess I haven't published fiction, so I can't tell you how different it is. But the stakes are different, and the money involved is different, and the sort of the touring, I guess, and the rollout is a little different. So I'm kind of trying to treat it like, I'm not trying to downplay it, but I want to treat it like almost like a light or introductory version of something that might come in the future, you know? And I'm so like honored to be able to share this book with the world. And I guess I feel like it's just gearing me up to want to do that with future projects. I guess in terms of, did you say like what I want to leave behind?
Yeah, I know in my own graduate work, I acquired a lot of kind of negative habits around writing, because I was always writing on a deadline and I was trying to produce, you know, kind of large quantity of work and often a short amount of time. And I realized from that process is like, okay, that taught me how to get a lot of words on the page. But I also started to associate a lot of other kind of like negative feelings or negative emotional states with the process of writing. And so I was curious if that was something that you experienced with this collection, and if finally having kind of a finalized artifact out in the world, if that kind of gives you a sense of clarity or ability to move forward in maybe ways that weren't there prior to having kind of like a final product.
Yeah, that's a great question, Andrew. Yeah, and I can also sympathize with some of those negative feelings around writing and drafting, that impulse to like pump out new work and just generate, fill a page. I don't know that was ever the case for this collection, I think. I feel like that's maybe a little bit closer to my relationship with fiction and writing prose in general, is the sort of, you know, get some words out. Let's hit this word count. What I'm happy with in terms of this collection being complete and together and an artifact in the world is it just gets to live in a different way for you know, someone who isn't just me. It's no longer just a Word document on my desktop. It's something that somebody will have probably very, you know, different experience with than myself. And that's the kind of mind-boggling and wonderful part of it. But I honestly felt it was complete when there was a moment where my friend Ale, who I went to grad school with in Iowa, was in the poetry program and I was in the fiction. Ale was the kind of my guide / editor / I don't know, they basically sat me down at this Mexican restaurant, and we went over like every single poem, and they basically did a sort of like a book report on my book, and it helped me kind of figure out a way to sequence things and just tease out these like different threads throughout. And after that process, I felt like it was done. And now that it's in the world, it's done in a different way, and it's done for other people to consume and think about. But I think that was the moment where I was like, this is the project, you know.
Having a trusted reader and a trusted sounding board, I feel like that's such a crucial thing in the writing process. You are listening to Madison Bookbeat here on WORT 89.9 FM, and we will return to this conversation with poet Steven Jung about his debut collection, At the End of the World, There is a Pond, in just a few minutes. But right now, I need to remind you that you're listening to Madison Bookbeat here on WORT. I'm Andrew Thomas, your first Monday of the Month host, and I'm joined today by my favorite partner in crime, Sarah Gabler. She's in the studio with me, helping keep the sound levels sounding good. And we're here to ask for your support during the WORT Spring Pledge Drive. Sarah, can you tell us a little bit about why this pledge drive is important?
Well, thank you, Andrew. And this spring day that feels like spring but is actually winter, we are here for the pledge drive to get folks to support the station, to show their love for independent media, a rare thing in these corporate conglomerated times. So we want you to give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 1, to show your support with a gift to the station so that we can continue to bring you this programming.
Yeah, you know, I've been a host here on Madison Bookbeat for, I think, about a year and a half now. And one of the things that I appreciate about it is that it is led by a team of hosts, like so many things here at the radio station. It's not just one person, but it is a collective of anywhere from 2 to 4 hosts who we pick a really wide range of different topics. And we get to talk to a lot of different writers, be it about fiction, be it about poetry, be it nonfiction. And we get to bring that to you, the Madison literary and listening community. For those of you who love to read a good book, mm-hmm. who are frequent shoppers at either Room of One's Own or Mystery to Me or Half Price Books, all the good bookstores that we have here in Madison. You appreciate the work that, you know, us volunteer hosts are able to do. We appreciate it when you acknowledge that for us, because sometimes volunteering can seem like lonely work, much like writing. You're often secluded by yourself, and it means so much to be able to bring this program to you, to get to hear up-and-coming writers, hear established writers, and, you know, people who value the written word, people who still believe that words mean things.
I do.
Yeah. I think Steven does too. Yeah. So there's at least 3 of us right now who believe that. Yeah. So yeah, if you value that and if you want to see that type of programming continue into the future, you can give us a call at 608-256-2001. You can also go online at WORTFM.org.
Yes. And let me hop in here to say we have a new online donor. Thank you, Anonymous, for your generous donation to the station. This donor left a comment for the Chuck Francis Tennis Group. So shout out to to you out there.
Yeah. Chuck Tennis.
Yeah. Thank you, new donor. We want new donors this hour and all week because we have a matching grant. A generous supporter of the station has committed to doubling any donation that comes from a new donor. So, wow, yes, show your love for the station this hour. If you haven't given in a while, we also want to hear from you too, because this generous matching grant will also apply to lapsed donors if you haven't given in the last few years. So give us a call or go online to WORTFM.org and show your support for the program Madison Bookbeat, because words, books, language, poetry, novels, they feed our souls.
It's true. It's true. And, you know, and this is something that we know that you value as listeners. I will say, if you are listening right now, thank you. We realize that Madison Bookbeat is often listened to as a podcast. And so if you are listening live right now, thank you for doing that. Please pass the word around to your friends about this program. Have folks download it from our archives or from wherever you get podcasts. We have such a wonderful backlog of interviews that you can go and listen to. Speaking of interviews, we're going to get back to my conversation with Steven Jung about his debut poetry collection, At the End of the World, There is a Pond, published this past January by Norton. And Steven will be at A Room of One's Own next Wednesday, March 12th, from 6 to 7 p.m. Steven, let's get our listeners a little more acquainted with the structure of the collection. I want to talk about that a little bit, and then I would love to hear you read one of the poems.
Yeah, absolutely.
So as mentioned, that the title is At the End of the World, There's a Pond. It's a very beautiful cover. It's kind of almost looks like watercolored or even like a colored pencil, but it looks like koi. Is that what it
yeah,
is?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, this piece is by an artist named Nata Metluk. And originally it was like an animation. So this is one frame from an animation by that artist. And it is koi, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, listeners, if you go to Stephen's website, you can actually see the animation being played out, and it is quite beautiful.
It's mesmerizing, yeah.
It is, yeah. The collection itself is broken up into four sections. So we have the jumpers, the swimmers, the sinkers, and the floaters. And as we've kind of already mentioned, what ties everything together are various metaphors related to water and the different speakers' orientations to it. And you take that in a lot of different directions, which makes the collection so engaging. But could you tell us a little bit more about the title and
Thank
then how you see the different sections relating both to the title and to each other?
Yeah, yeah, of course. At the end of the world, there's a pond. I think I began probably with pond, although I knew that a lot of the poems I was writing had sort of themes of, you know, kind of the apocalyptic, the post-human, what comes after, like the aftermath. And I think I arrived on pond because I wanted a body of water at the center of the work. I wanted to think of the book at times as like a container, and you know, I'm filling it with these different things. I'm stocking it with different animals and like wildlife and plants. And I felt like pond was very it's very much what I was going for, because a pond can be an incredibly wild body of water. I grew up in Southern California. It's not that many ponds, but when I went to Massachusetts, I just see a bajillion. They can be, yeah, they're very much wild. Things I would have referred to as lakes, I guess, back home are called ponds elsewhere. But I grew up with ponds as like little koi ponds, you know, and you're in a yard or something. And I think it reflects these two themes that are present in a lot of the poems, one being sort of the natural world, and sort of how things exist in nature, and then the other sort of theme is like artifice and containment, and how we take little chunks of the natural world and sort of put them on display and cramp them in sort of to become little microcosms of our own world. And so I felt like I wanted a title that got to both of these ideas. And I actually remember coming up with this title because a friend asked me if they could see my manuscript, and I said, I have one, and then I didn't really have one, and I had to pull it together, and I had to find a title, and I think I arrived at it pretty quickly. And then I actually wrote the title poem, like the very first poem in the book, after having come up with the title for the book. I just thought I would like to have a title poem like worthy of this title that I love. And so, yeah. Oh, and the sections, right? Yeah, the sections are the jumpers, the swimmers, the sinkers, and the floaters. There are these four sections, and I think a lot of the book reckons with mental illness and sort of suicidal ideation. And I think these are all different orientations you can have towards water, like you said, Andrew, like jumping in the water, swimming in the water, sinking in the water, or floating in the water. But I felt like they're also kind of orientations towards suicide or suicidal ideation as well, and that's part of also how the book is structured. Like I wanted it to end on floating rather than, you know, sinking or jumping or swimming. I wanted, I guess, a sense of hope, but not a sense of hope that was overinflated or phony, I guess.
It seems like a lot of things that end with kind of a call to hope seem kind of naive, and it seemed like your work was able to avoid that. And the floating is a kind of, I wouldn't want to say stasis, but a kind of just being present and being with the surrounding environment. I was also noticing, you know, a lot of imagery of kind of potentially sinking into the self or kind of plumbing the depths of pain or violence or addiction. And even relationships with, you know, a lot of the speakers are thinking about their relationships with the mother or their father. I was also just curious to know, like, given what some of your poems are talking about, it's clear that your Vietnamese heritage is coming through to some degree because, you know, there's discussion mm-hmm. of diaspora, you know, being a proper or improper refugee. And at one point you mentioned how the word, I believe in Vietnamese, the word for country and water, it's the same word in Vietnamese. And you say in one of your poems, Ho Chi Minh City, you say, so much of this country's goodness faces the water. And so I was curious to know, like, you know, how does your Vietnamese heritage kind of inform some of what you're thinking about, particularly like in relation to like processing this through your parents?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I've had such a, like a changing relationship to, well, one, my Vietnamese-ness, but also how I write or think about it, you know, in my work, whether that's fiction or poetry. A big part of the, I mean, I can only speak for my own experience and, you know, sort of my parents, you know, they can't stand in for their whole generation, but among the Vietnamese refugees and immigrants I grew up with, there's this sense of loss after the Vietnam War. Most of the Vietnamese community in the U.S. are from the South. And so they have this sense that the country was lost, you know, after the fall of Saigon, they have lost their country. And so it's a sense of grief for something that they think is lost, but it was hard to think about as a kid. But then you sort of get older, and I visited Vietnam myself. Some of the poems in the book have to do with, yeah, some of my traveling in Vietnam. You realize that it's not lost. There's a whole country here, and there's a whole people here, and everybody here speaks the language and reads Vietnamese literature and thinks and eats and breathes Vietnamese. And so it was difficult for me to kind of sometimes write about Vietnamese heritage and sort of like my connection to my parents without leaning into these kind of tropes, I guess, these like diaspora tropes of the immigrant kid, second generation, struggling to connect with both his parents' roots and sort of his own like American upbringing. And I try to get at that through maybe like a slant way. You mentioned that poem that in which that little fact about like water, the word for water and the word for country being the same word in Vietnamese. The poem is titled Novel. It's about somebody writing a novel that includes that line. It's like, because it's a little meta, but it's a line that I wrote at one point, but it's not a line that I especially love now. And so that poem is kind of interrogating like this older self who wrote about Vietnameseness in a very specific way. And, you know, is that the right way to think about it? Is it a kind of self-exoticization? Vietnamese is a beautiful language though. And you know, there are things about it that are really unique and beautiful. But how do you write about that? And so, yeah, I think there's a trap sometimes, you know, writing about the Vietnam War, especially in a specific way. So the book has to do with my heritage, has to do with Vietnameseness and my folks. A lot of it also has to deal with how to write about that stuff, how to think about it, how to make art about it. So it becomes a little meta poetic or meta fictional about that specifically. Yeah.
Yeah, I know just from some of my own reading that, you know, kind of a noticeable body of both Vietnamese and Vietnamese American literature really kind of started taking off from what I've read in like the 80s and 90s. And then we've kind of seen even a resurgence within the last, like, I don't know, like eight to 10 years, like you said, with like Viet Tan Nguyen Thi Bui and as well as others, as kind of the next generation of writers that, you know, is identifying with Vietnamese-ness, but also kind of questioning it. Like, how do you see yourself, as well as some of your peers? How do you see yourself kind of, like you were mentioning, like interrogating these ideas of diaspora and memory, and trying to get away from, like what you said, is like kind of at this point, these kind of cliched tropes of what it means to be a member of a refugee community or something like that. How do you see kind of your generation of writers playing with this?
Yeah, again, I think it's a little sometimes difficult to speak for a lot of people, you know, I always hesitate to speak for Vietnamese people or like young Vietnamese people, even to other Vietnamese people. It's hard to, I know, generalize sometimes. But personally, the way I am interested in interrogating some of those questions, some of those tropes, is by, and it's not something new, it's not a new approach or anything, but I've been trying to write more about writing, I guess. I've been trying to have speakers and narrators and characters in my fiction as well that are, you know, kind of self-reflexive and self-reflective as well. People who are concerned with those questions and how to articulate them. And so I think that, I don't know, it's just hard when you know, you grow up with one really very specific understanding of the war. And by the way, like most, at least most of the Vietnamese folks in my parents' generation that I know are really deeply conservative. They're, you know, they, can we talk about this?
Sure.
You can, right?
Like, yeah, I mean,
they probably, you know, they probably voted for Trump a third time. They think, again, try not to do the broadest strokes, but it's just data, you know, they, you know, think that not another immigrant or refugee should set foot in the country for however many years. Like they, you know, we were the good refugees, and the refugees that are coming now, seeking asylum now, these people are troublemakers and criminals. And, you know, they've really internalized this like American superiority myth. And it's kind of upsetting. So I think my approach to Vietnamese-ness kind of forces me to have to think so much about what it means to be American and like, you know, a naturalized American, or you're born here. So I think another way I'm getting at those questions is just by thinking so much about what it means to be American and American and an American writer. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and that's a great answer. And you know, like even maybe the way that I set up the question was even kind of reinforcing some of those tropes as well. But you know, I think at this point it would be great to hear some of this poetry. I don't want to withhold from our audience too much. So this is Stephen Young. We're talking about his new poetry collection, debut poetry collection, published in January. At the end of the world, there is a pond. And I believe this first poem is called Break in Case of Extinction Event.
Yes. Thanks, Andrew. Yeah, this is Break in Case of Extinction Event. Again, thank you for tuning in. And thanks for everyone who's supporting the station. Madison Book Beat is awesome, and so is Wart. Okay. That's not in the poem.
That's the poem. It's really short. Yeah.
yeah, exactly. Okay, Break in Case of Extinction Event. When the earth enters its blue phase and the rivers leave their beds unmade, when hurricanes pull undersea your father's father's fishery, and the sea shakes down the sky, and the insulin flows like oil, when you stop dreaming of catfish with pearls for eyes and pill cutter mouths, when the south unfurls its newborn coast like a series of ferns, and your mother toasts her cardiac surgeon, and the savannah continues to burn. When we kayak down the road to loot the pharmacy named for the oligarch, when we unplug the doomsday clock and guillotine the clocksmiths in Central Park, and your little brother wins the war and nothing more, this is when. Then, and only then, and only then.
That is Stephen Young reading from his new poetry collection, At the End of the World, There is a Pond. You heard it here on WORT 89.9 FM. We are also in the middle of our spring pledge drive, as you've been hearing us talking about so far. And, you know, talking to Stephen just now, I should mention that Sarah Gabler, my partner in crime and fellow producers here in the studio with me, you know, talking to Stephen about, you know, kind of interacting with older generations, it reminds me about one of probably the best features of WORT, at least for me as a volunteer, and hopefully for you as listeners as well, is that it is probably the most intergenerational space that I regularly interact with here in Madison. As somebody in my 30s, it's very easy to primarily be in circles where I'm with other folks who are probably in their like 20s to 40s. At WORT, we are celebrating our 50th year this year. So we have some folks who have been here from the very beginning, all the way back in the 70s. And I want to see WORT continue for another 50 years. And so part of that is, yes, we need your financial support. We would also love to have your engagement. If you are listening right now, if you're in your 20s, you're in your 30s, you're in your 40s, and you were kind of terrified by what we're seeing on the news every day. I should probably say like every 45 minutes, every 30 minutes. And you're wondering what to do. Local community supported programming that we do here at WORT is one primary way that you can get in on this. I don't know, Sarah, I've been talking for a bit. Like what has your experience been like volunteering at WORT and getting to interact with just so many different people from so many different backgrounds and ages?
Yeah, it's a great feature of this station. I mean, I don't have a lot of elders in my life, and I can find them here. People that I can learn from, people that have a lot to teach me about how to do a community project like this, how to keep volunteers engaged, how to make friends, and how to do something meaningful in your community. And that's a hard thing to do as an adult. And I'm glad I have people that I can trust to teach me how to be better here at WORT. People who have a lot more knowledge about the world. And, you know, I think it's a give and take. You know, people learn from each other. And I think those of you who are listening are probably listening because you're a curious person, because you want to learn more about the world. You're tuned into a show about poetry because you're curious about how other people express their ideas and their experiences. So kudos to you. Also, kudos to you if you send us a little monetary gift to show your support of the station. You can do so by calling us at 608-256-2001. Talk to Mary Lou on the other side of that phone, who will gladly take your pledge, or go online to wortfm.org and leave a donation online, where we will take that and put it to good use. One of the things that we were able to do after the last pledge drive last year was to get some new soundboards in the studio that are bringing you some fine audio quality radio. What do you think, Andrew, about the new soundboards?
I mean, I think they sound great. As a as somebody who started as a sound engineer, I was very excited to get new soundboards to be able to bring folks this wonderful, I think as the 6 o'clock news calls it, handcrafted programming.
Yeah.
Handcrafted for your ears. So one more time, the number is 608-256-2001. Your financial support helps keep programs like this alive. If you want to even get more involved, you can go onto WORT's website and figure out how you can volunteer here and get involved and lend your hand to developing and maintaining an intergenerational space that is trying to be a progressive voice and be a progressive stance in a pretty hostile world. And so we might have to break something in case of an extinction event pretty soon to get us back to the poetry of Stephen Jung, who is joining us today from, you're at home, right? You're in Atlanta.
You know what? I'm actually on campus. I'm at Emory University where I'm teaching. So hello from Atlanta. And I also wanted to say both of you have such beautiful voices. I would tune in just for the voices. You know, you guys could be talking about, you know, I was trying to think of something. I like so many.
We could read a phone book.
Yeah. You could read a phone book. Yeah. You could read a treatise on worms. So shout out to you guys.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Stephen. You know, Stephen, as your last poem suggested, the poem that you read before that quick little break in case of extinction event, as your last poem suggested, and as you've alluded to a few times, many of what you write about deals directly or indirectly with climate change and our natural world. And you have this one phrase that as I was prepping for this interview and I was doing a little bit of reading around, I saw this one quoted a number of times. And so this one has really stuck with people. So in your poem Anatomy, the speaker says, quote, "There's no point in writing nature poems anymore. Not unless you drown the verses in smoke and oil and organophosphates. The Anthropocene demands a new syntax." Question for you is, how has poetry helped you make sense of our ongoing climate crisis? Because you write with so much kind of like precision and verve and kind of humor. And so much of what you were writing about is quite heavy. So yeah, how has poetry helped you make sense of this issue of climate extinction?
Yeah. No, that's really kind, Andrew. I'm very much like many people of my generation, as well as, you know, the generation like that's kind of coming up right below us. We're sort of coming of age in the climate crisis. And I just feel like sometimes everything feels like one step away from doom. And I don't mean that just with like the climate. I mean, I just think that these little institutions that are supposed to, you know, keep us on the right path, like they're just not there sometimes. Like we're sort of falling into like a, you know, fascist takeover a little bit. And yet these are dark things. These are extinction sort of level events in my the way I figure them. I think part of reckoning with like this idea of apocalypse, this idea of climate crisis, climate like end of the road, I just kind of connected it a lot to like my own experiences and thoughts around, again, I mentioned it a little bit earlier, but like suicidal ideation and this idea of wanting to leave, not necessarily die, but like leave the earth, like leave this plane. And how part of, you know, leaving here would also mean leaving this place that's falling apart. And is that like a sort of selfish impulse? I think it is. But I think it's an impulse a lot of people have. They don't see much hope in the future. That, you know, I can't really fault anybody for feeling that way. But I think another important thing about dealing with all of this in the book is, like you said, the kind of humor, and it's sometimes like a black or dark humor, I would say. It's a little wry maybe, but it's really hard for me to write about something that is like fundamentally really upsetting to me without trying to crack a joke or at least trying to approach it slant, like tell it slant, the Dickinsonism, but like going at it from an angle that isn't this angle that we're, you know, we're all going at, which is we're all going to die, or it doesn't matter, you know, nothing's going to happen. I think coming slant, and I think poetry is a way of going slant into any subject material. I think like fiction or nonfiction prose, I can sometimes see that as maybe more of the straightforward way to broach these. Like disasters and apocalyptic scenarios. But with poetry, you could kind of dance around it in a different way. And I think hopefully maybe get at them in ways you can't necessarily do with prose or reporting, as important as those things are. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, one of your speakers, it's in the poem Livingstonia Postcard. I think it's the opening line that the speaker says, "I'm trying to write plainly." And, you know, I immediately made probably the number one sin in reading poetry is conflating the author with the speaker of the poem. But, you know, I did take that line, "I'm trying to write plainly," And I really did kind of see that as kind of a through line throughout the work, because it is both like plain writing, but because of its plainness, like and the juxtapositions that you're able to create, it's quite beautiful and startling at times. And the clarity that you're able to get out of quote unquote, like plain writing. And so what you were just talking about, it made me want to think a little bit more for those of us who aren't practicing poets. The various poetic forms can kind of be a bit daunting as far as kind of making sense of them. So, you know, a few things that I notice is like you include the sonnet. I think I saw some free verse in there, some quatrains and couplets. So to get in the weeds with poetry, probably the most we'll do today, but is, can you just talk to us a little bit about the composition process and how you use these different poetic forms as kind of like different tools to as you're saying, as to kind of tell its slant, like how do these different forms help you do that?
Yeah. I mean, with form in general, with these, like, I guess what are called strict forms, like the, you know, the sonnet, I use something called the ghazal, which is from like an Urdu Arabic language tradition, but it's obviously made its way into English, especially contemporary poetry. These forms, they ask something of you as the writer, that sort of writing prose or writing in sort of free or even blank verse does not ask, which is, I mean, for the sonnet, it asks that you remain within the bounds of like the syllabic or like the metrical structure of the sonnet. It also asks that you keep it to 14 lines, keep it snappy. These are like little boxes, and I think that's maybe like a little bit nail on the head when it comes to this whole concern of bodies of water and containment and aquariums. That really is how I felt with those boxes, those sonnets. I write my sonnets. I don't differentiate like stanzas with the sonnets. They're just these little rectangles on the page. They have to do so much work with kind of so little, and I think that is the challenge that is really exciting to me. Is having to make do with this form that's been handed down, which has, like, you know, such a long tradition, and making it sort of serve my purposes. And then in that, it's a give and take. Like, I have to serve some of the purposes of the sonnet and the tradition of the sonnet, but it's giving a lot to me. It's giving structure. It's giving constraints. It's providing this, like, very valuable pressure. And then to get to what you said about like plain, or I'm trying to write plainly, plain writing, that's the writing that is, you know, like affects me the most when I read it, I think. And it's not always on first read. I think something fun about like writing a little bit in the vernacular a little more, or something more colloquial, or just dipping in and out of different registers too, is you can, you can give something that's easy to kind of consume, but then the digesting maybe takes a little bit longer, something like that. Like, yeah, it's like simple to read, but there's something deceptive about it. And, you know, I think my poetry is, there's so much about like appearances and what's underneath them. And so that's part of it. Yeah.
One of the like key pleasures, I think, of reading your poems that I was picking up on is, again, that, you know, I'm thinking back to college poetry classes now, but is the idea of enjambment, you know, is like where a line begins and it ends. And just hearing it read aloud doesn't quite do it justice, but you have some beautiful moments where, even though it's, you know, it's simple, straightforward language, it's what you're able to do with the enjambment that really kind of makes it. So, you know, again,
thank you, Andrew.
Yeah.
That means everything to every poet. So
I'll keep that in my back pocket then. But, you know, I'd love, I'd love for our listeners, you know, we're going to break here soon, and, you know, the hour has flown by, but I would love for us to hear one more of your poems, Stephen. Right now I'm in conversation with Stephen Jung. We've been talking about his debut poetry collection. It's barely 2 months old. It's called At the End of the World, There is a Pawn. It was published in January by Norton. Stephen, I would love to hear I Vow to Stop Putting It Mildly.
All right. Again, thank you everybody for tuning in to Madison Bookbeat with Andrew and Sarah, and today Stephen. Yeah, I just really, I love programs like this. Like, you know, I just like community programs, and I like literary communities, and I like communities where I get to interact with people who are very, very different from me and yet very, very similar. And that's this kind of space. So you should really support it, everybody. And I can't wait to see some of y'all in person in Madison. Okay, I vow to stop, putting it mildly. My father voted for your father to die. He did this with great enthusiasm, animated by what he believed was the spirit of his own father, a civil engineer who spent a year in a re-education camp. My father put your father in a camp. He did this with his hands, swiftly and without regrets, a harmonica strapped to his neck like a Jesus piece. My father is the Biggie Smalls of calculated losses, the Bob Dylan of towns on fire. Once I saw in his face an invasive species of love, which said, if you really love me, you must be someone I can love. Twice he translated my poems so his mother might better know me. There is kindness here, but there are kindnesses everywhere. One day I will teach my children to climb the ladder I am always climbing. Or I won't. There's a chance I won't.
Stephen Jung reading the final poem from his poetry collection, At the End of the World, There is a Pond. And as we wrap up that collection, I see that the clock on the wall says that we're going to have to be wrapping up here pretty soon, but not before Sarah and I one more time kind of build on Stephen's praise of this program and of local community-supported programming. Here at WORT right now, we are in our spring pledge drive. And, you know, I think the final thing that I'd kind of like us to think on is if you ever visit the WORT building, if you walk in and you're on the first floor and you walk down the hallway, it is the office where Adrian and Doug are sitting. But on their door, they have this beautiful hand-printed poster that says, Defend Public Media. And that's something that's really been resonating with me for probably like the last 6 to 8 months, but especially since January 6th, or I shouldn't say January. Well, yeah, I guess that was the inauguration, but thinking about what is it going to be like in years to come if we don't step up and defend public media, if we start to see bigger and bigger crackdowns. And I know we feel that like Madison is a relatively safe space, that we are in this kind of blue bubble in an otherwise purple state. But as we have seen rollbacks on so many things, so many protections that we were not anticipating seeing rolled back, you really need to ask yourself, what does it mean to defend public media? And, you know, we ask for your financial support so we can continue to do programming like this. We ask for your, you know, your labor hours, if you're able to give it, to also help put on programming like this, to be behind the scenes, to answer the phone, to sit at the computer, answer emails for folks, to volunteer in a variety of ways. But, you know, that's really what I want us to think about now. As we celebrate 50 years of WORT, we want to be able to celebrate 100 years of WORT at some point. Sarah, it looks like you got a little bit of news for us.
Yes, I do. I want to thank somebody who's called in with a donation, with a pledge to defend WORT, to defend this independent community radio station. Thank you so much, Patty, for your generous donation. Patty loves the show's Global Revolution, A Public Affair on Mondays, which if you listened to the show before BookBeat today, you heard Douglas Haynes, our Monday host, talking about water protections. So these two shows have been in synergy with each other. So Patty, I hope you listen to that one. And Patty also loves letters and politics. So thank you so much for supporting WORT 89.9 FM. You can do that like Patty did by giving the station a call at 608-256-2001 or by going online at wortfm.org. And I think that this conversation has been so beautiful and connected to the role of independent media by bringing you the arts. Like, that's one thing that WORT does really well. We bring you fantastic music programs. You're not going to get top 40 here. You know, we play music that our volunteers want to play and that our listeners love to hear. And we bring you programs about the literary arts. Programs like this one with Stephen that can give you the tools for living life a little slant through poetry. So thank you, Stephen. And we hope that in the last minute that we have here on the show that we can get another caller or another online donation. Andrew, take it away.
Yeah, so I do want to wrap up the show. You know, today I've been in conversation with Stephen Jung about his debut poetry collection, At the End of the World, There is a Pond, published this past January by Norton. Get it wherever you get your books. It's a beautiful book. And if you show up at Room of One's Own on Wednesday, March 12th, between 6 and 7 p.m., you will get to see Stephen in person. You'll get to hear a lot more of these beautiful poems. So that is A Room of One's Own, 2717 Atwood Avenue, from 6 to 7 p.m. You can get this collection signed. Stephen, I very much look forward to your reading next week. And just a big thank you again for joining us for a conversation today, and thank especially you. During a pledge drive. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. You guys are amazing, and your listeners are lucky to have you. Long live public media.
Thank you. You've been listening to Madison BookBeat, and I am usually your first Monday of the month host, Andrew Thomas. Next month, that will change a little bit. I will be back on April 14th for my next interview. But please tune into my fellow Madison BookBeat host, Sarah Batke's show on April 7th. You can find a full-length recording of the interview on WORTFM.org and a podcast version wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to today's talk producer, Sarah Gabler, and news director, Shelley Pittman. Coming up next is 3 hours of jazz with Alex Walding White. So keep it here on WORT 89.9 FM Madison, listener-sponsored community radio.
You're tuned to WORT 89.9 FM in Madison.
Radio Kiosk for Monday, March 3rd.
How would you...
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Monday, March 3rd.
How would you like... to be executed. I'm Bill Newman for the Civil Liberties Minute. That was the question that South Carolina recently asked Brad Sigmund, age 67, on death row for killing his ex-girlfriend's parents in 2001. Sigmund's options: the electric